rock and roll.
Those seeking freedom, to those committed to abolishing slavery, to those who want liberation for all. This is a message from the revolutionary abolitionist movement. The United States was built on slavery, and despite the American Civil War, this oppression never ended. The abolitionist movement fought against this tyranny, but modern slavery and mass brutality persists unchecked. Fascism is on the rise. The state has openly declared war on our communities, threatening to ethnically cleanse Latinos, criminalize Muslims, destroy indigenous land, and oppress the LGBT community while continuing to murder and incarcerate black people. The revolutionary abolitionist movement unequivocally states the plantation system must be destroyed. Today, the anarchist struggle and anti-statist feminism are flourishing, and authoritarian modes of resistance have been discredited. The Rojava Revolution in northern Syria has set a new standard with a foundation in feminism, ecology, anti-state organizing, an armed struggle, and has actualized the path towards liberation beyond 20th century nationalism. With the founding of groups like the International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Forces, it is clear that this is the time for anarchist revolutionaries to act without hesitation. We declare our solidarity with the international anti-fascist and anarchist struggle and propose concrete steps in the fight for abolition. Revolutionary abolitionists must fight hand in hand with those facing oppression. We intend to establish a new underground railroad to free people from bondage by building revolutionary self-defense networks, connecting them to one another, and developing militant strategies in their neighborhoods. Our network will create the capacity to destroy state power and defend our communities. A new global paradigm for revolution has been established to be taken up by dedicated, committed revolutionaries, autonomous territories, guerrillas in armed struggle, and all those engaged in the global drive towards liberation and away from statehood, capitalism, patriarchy, and domination. We call on anti-state revolutionary groups to join the revolutionary abolitionist movement and send this message to our comrades to help build the capacity to burn down the American plantation once and for all. Welcome to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. This is your host and comrade, Sergio Castillo. We are here live on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome, 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 comrades, to another edition of Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. I am your host and comrade, Sergio Castillo. Thank you so much for joining us. First, as always, a few announcements from Radio Free Brooklyn. As you know, COVID-19 has disrupted all of our lives, and we at Radio Free Brooklyn are no different. This is why we humbly ask for any donations that you can make. It would be extremely generous of you, and your donations help this operation keep going. We are a nonprofit organization, so anything helps. You can go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. Also, if you'd like to listen to Radio Free Brooklyn when you're not in front of your computer, please consider downloading our free mobile app for iPhone and Android, available in the App Store for iPhone or the Google Play Store for Android. Please be sure to subscribe to our monthly newsletter for the latest news about new programming and upcoming Radio Free Brooklyn events. You can sign up at radiofreebrooklyn.org/newsletter. And one additional announcement we have today. Radio Free Brooklyn is sponsored in part by ProCare Biomedical Repair, offering little or no cost medical braces. More information is available at 844-598-6639. So there's that. At this time, we at Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio would like to read a brief statement on the current crisis in Cuba. We call for the immediate end to the U.S. embargo, which has strangled the Cuban population for decades. We fully support the right to self-determination by the Cuban masses. And while we fully claim to be anti-statist, we in no way support any military intervention by the United States. The CIA's campaign of terrorism against Cuba is well documented, and its attempt to undermine and destroy the revolution is extensive. We believe the best way to help the Cuban population at this difficult time is by fully and totally ending the imposed U.S. embargo and to keep the imperialist war machine out of Cuba's political affairs. Our guest today marks another chapter in our program's journey to freedom and liberation. She is an actor, writer, director, producer for both film and the theater. In film, she has appeared in For Profit, Where the Magic Happens, which she also served as the film's writer and director, Still Cool, Lowlands, Twinkle, The Holy Deal, and Grove Lake. While a student of directing at UCLA, she was an active member of Shakespeare UCLA, starring in several productions. She went on to direct a production of Romeo and Juliet set in 1989 Berlin. She served as the co-chair of the Student Advisory Committee at the Hammer Museum and was the co-founder of Interactivists. In 2013, she received a master's degree in acting at USC. Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio is very proud to welcome Whitney Ellis. Whitney, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here, Sergio.
So where to begin, perhaps at the beginning? Whitney, where were you born?
I was born in Orange, California.
What was your father's name?
Mark Howard Ellis.
What was his occupation?
He's an allergist and immunologist.
What was your mother's name?
Shelley Ann Taranto.
What was her occupation?
Lawyer.
Did storytelling play a role in your life as a child?
Yes. My brother and I started writing plays when we were very young and putting them on in the neighborhood and casting our friends and making films since we were little kids.
What was the name of your elementary school?
St. Jean de Lestinac.
What was the name of your middle school?
Orange County School of the Arts.
What high school did you attend?
Orange County High School of the Arts.
Were you a good student?
Yes.
What made you a good student?
I was always a very, really, curious little kid. I always wanted to know why and how things worked. And I'm infamous for asking a lot of questions. If I'm in a class, I'm the one raising the hands, kind of being that annoying little kid, raising my hand, asking the teacher lots of questions.
When did you discover that the theater would play a significant role in your life?
I think from probably like kindergarten. My mom and my sister went out of town on a trip to Europe with some family, and my brother and my dad and I were home, and my dad has always been obsessed with Shakespeare, and so he wanted us to learn each of us to learn a Shakespearean monologue, and so I learned a Shakespearean monologue, and my brother did, and then by the time my mom came back, we kind of put it on as like a little play. I know that sounds like super nerdy, but yeah, like my dad is like a big Shakespeare geek.
What monologue did you perform?
I did Henry V, and And then I also did Much Ado About Nothing.
You did Henry V when you were a child.
Yeah, but like I said, my parents were Shakespeare geeks, and like we grew up watching Kenneth Branagh as Henry V. So that was like our idea of like heroes in our household was like, you know, Kenneth Branagh making, you know, Henry V. Not the traditional household.
What university did you attend?
University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA.
Did they have a theater department?
Yes, they did. And that's where I met you. And I majored in directing.
Tell us about studying at UCLA.
I always, you know, I actually didn't start off in the theater department. I started off in the design media arts department as in the video. Like I applied with a lot of my film submissions. You know, I made a lot of films growing up, and so I got into that department initially, for my video work. And then, but I was always like still involved in the theater department. I was in the, you know, Shakespeare UCLA acting in plays, and then was, you know, applied to direct a show, Romeo and Juliet, set in 1989 Berlin. Right before the fall of the wall. And then I just wanted to go further. So then I applied to the theater department and ended up being in that department and learning a lot about directing Shakespeare and directing contemporary plays.
Who taught your directing for Shakespeare class?
I was Michael Hackett.
Tell us about studying with Michael Hackett.
Yeah, I directed a scene from Anthony and Cleopatra, and it was fun. It was like really about like just learning, you know, learning as you're doing. It was not a ton about theory, but more about just putting stuff up and seeing what happens, you know. And that was very. I was thinking about that the other day. I really think that's like the best way you can learn in art. Is like you can read theory till you're blue in the face, but it's. I find for me personally, like I learn the best when I'm just kind of getting my hands dirty in the clay, you know, and just like putting stuff up and seeing what works and seeing it in front of a live audience.
What drew you to the classical theater?
I think, you know, being raised around Shakespeare from such a young age was huge. And, you know, and going to the theater, my parents loved going to the theater. We went to South Coast Repertory a lot growing up. And also my grandma, my dad's mom, she was a teacher by trade, but she always loved theater. And so she would write plays herself, not professionally, but she just loved to do that. So when we were little, you know, she would, she wrote a play and cast all the grandkids, and kind of seeing that, being part of that process as like a little kid, I think definitely inspired me.
What is it that appeals to you in classical text? I mean, why do you think these stories still radiate with audiences today? What radiates for you personally?
I think because it's, I mean, not to sound cliche, but just like it's the human condition. It's like it doesn't matter what time period we're in. We still have the same wants. We still have the same foibles. We have the same a lot of the same desires. That's, I think, the beauty of some of these texts is that you really can put them at any time period, and they'll still ring true.
While a student at UCLA, you directed a production of Romeo and Juliet set in 1989 Berlin. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Well, the summer before I had been in, you know, traveling in Berlin and also had seen the film The Lives of Others, which is a German film, and you know, a lot of it had to do with the Stasi and the secret police, and I had been fascinated by this idea of, you know, of these two lovers, you know, trying to you know, be together, but then there was this oppression, you know, keeping them apart. And I just, I felt like that setting was perfect for that story. I'd never seen anything like it. Romeo and Juliet is a very classic story, but I'd never seen it done in that way. And I became friends with this very, very talented production designer that's actually based in New York, currently Starlet Jacobs. And she, I wanted to build a Berlin Wall, you know. We didn't really have much funding. You know, we ended up applying for a grant from UCLA and got the funding. We didn't have a ton of money to play with, so we really had to do it very bare bones, but we worked with what we had. And Starlet was like, you know, let's do it. Let's build a Berlin Wall. And in my mind, I wanted to have it shift to east to west Berlin. And so she built, flattened the wall, and we all built it as a cast and crew together. She taught me how to use power tools, and we built this wall, and it came to life, and we had a watchtower. And I really wanted the actors and the crew to get into that time period, so I created a playlist from that time period. I researched a lot about the music in Germany at that time, and what music was in, you know, East and West. And I created a playlist for each cast and crew member. And I wanted them, I told them, listen to it when you're in the shower, listen to it when you're driving the car. I want you to be immersed in this environment. And everyone did. And it was really, really a fun, fun experience. And I really wanted to create an interactive environment for the audience. So when they came to the theater, we had people dressed up as, you know, in the military uniforms. And we created these stamps that said Romeo and Juliet, and the programs looked like a bureaucratic form. So when the audience showed up, they had the stamps that said Romeo and Juliet, and they, you know, went into the theater, and we sectioned off the theater into East and West Berlin. And so we staged someone trying to run over to the other side, and then had fight choreography where the military, you know, would kind of beat that person up. So needless to say, the audience didn't try to move to the other side of the theater after they saw that.
In 2010, you made a significant choice to study acting at USC. What inspired this decision?
I knew in my soul that I wanted to really, really focus on acting, you know, more professionally, and to really, really be in that environment. I auditioned for USC, and they had great teachers there, and I won a fellowship, and they, you know, and it was a great team of people, and we got to actually do three plays, like an ensemble style theater. So we did three plays at the same time, which was another thing that I really wanted to do, which was do, you know, classical theater and do contemporary theater, and do that at the same time, and have that, you know, level of rigor.
What drew you to pursue film, not only as an actor, but as a director?
I grew up watching a lot of films, and I grew up watching, you know, to my parents' credit, I think they really, you know, I had some friends that were like very censored. They, you know, they couldn't watch certain films, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily a good thing, but it did open me up to like all these different, you know, artistic films at a very, very young age. So I grew up watching Stanley Kubrick movies when I was like really, really young, and Wings of Desire, and like, you know, all these like really artistic kind of films. So watching them from a very young age, and then I think my favorite book when I was like in seventh grade was I remember seeing Stanley Kubrick films and being just like taken with them, and just, you know, the cinematography and just how beautiful they were and thoughtful. And also the trailers for those films, like the trailer for The Shining, like it's literally these, you know, elevator doors opening and then this blood rushing out. And it just like, it was so simple. And it was such a contrast to some of the trailers today that give a lot of the story away. And I just loved how simple it was and how engaged the imagination. And so I just was really obsessed. And that was probably the book I read over and over and over again. It was a book about, it was like Stanley Kubrick, A Life in Pictures or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it had, you know, the pages were dog-eared. And so from a very young age, I just was obsessed.
Well, talk to us more about Stanley Kubrick, who is maybe one of the most influential directors in the history of cinema. I mean, he was a very eclectic filmmaker. He made many different types of films. I mean, what drew you to the stories that he told?
I think some of it was that he focused a lot on outsiders. Not always, but like I think for some of them, it was just, maybe not necessarily outside. It was people that like, he kind of gave a new perspective on people. It was a bit like off kilter. You know what I mean? Like it was not necessarily outsiders, but it was more like the kind of desires of a human that might not be as pretty as some, you know what I mean? It's the secret desires of some humans, you know? And he did it in a very like, unabashed way.
Has studying theater formally helped or hindered your skills as a film director?
Any chance to just make stuff and learn and do stuff is helpful. But I will say, I think sometimes learning too much about technical things can hinder because, you know, it kind of takes you away from that, that childlike quality. And I think more than ever right now, I want to get back to the childlike quality of just, you know, that purity, you know, and less about just the technical aspects.
Well, talk to us more about this childlike purity you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, talk to us about it. I mean, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that I think a lot of times, you know, like for example, with like acting, you know, it's really about the imagination, or even film too, like directing. It's about the imagination, and the childlike quality is just tapping into that imagination, that just like never ending imagination. Right. And, when you're like too concerned with the technical aspects of, you know, of acting or the technique or, the technical aspects of filmmaking, I think that kind of can take away from that. Imagination where you're just like playing. It's a state of play. It's a state of, you're loose, you know, you're free before you're going into, making something, making some art piece.
Do you think it's important for actors to study formally?
You know what? I used to think so, but not necessarily. I think if you, a lot of it has to do with keeping that imagination intact, you know, and playing and just letting your mind daydream. And, you know, David Lynch talks about this a lot, of just having time to just let your mind wander, I think is very, very key, you know. It's key in creating characters. It's key in creating worlds. I think some of my favorite ideas have come from, you know, when I'm just, you know, on a walk in nature and I just let my mind wander. And, you know, that's actually, you know, when I thought of directing Romeo and Juliet in East and West Berlin, I was just walking around, letting my mind wander. And, you know, some of my favorite ideas come up that way. It's basically allowing yourself the freedom to just be, you know, and no expectations of what's going to happen, but what I have found for myself personally is that a lot of exciting things happen that way.
What about studying directing formally? I know Peter Sellers, the theater director, not the film director for our audiences, who was something of a mentor of yours, if I remember correctly, has claimed he has never taken a theater class in his life. And I believe Robert Wilson has said the same. How do you feel about studying directing formally?
You know, I'm glad I had the opportunity to do it, but do I think it's necessary? No, I don't. I think it's, you know, it's, you know, you have added tools in your toolbox, but I really genuinely believe that you learn the most, you know, I've learned the most by doing, just putting stuff up, you know. I was halfway through that Shakespeare directing class when I directed Romeo and Juliet. I was totally scared out of my mind, you know, right before I did that, because I, you know, actors about to show up to rehearsal, you know, and you're like, oh my gosh, what do I do? But I found that it made me prepare more. It made me really think about things before I went to rehearsal. It made me really do 10 times more research, you know, but also it also helped me realize that a lot of times you have to leave space for the unknown. You have to leave space for the unexpected, the surprises. And sometimes those are the most fun. The actors will come in and bring something that you didn't even think of. And to not be too tied to your vision, but to have it, allow it to be flexible enough to bend and to change and to turn into something even more wonderful than you ever dreamed of.
Tell us more about what attracts you to a project.
I think, you know, different things. I mean, I have journals and journals and journals of just like, you know, little seedlings of ideas, you know? So it could be, I think of a person I saw, that like a character that I thought was really interesting, or it was like a lot of times it's the concept. It's more of like a filmmaking idea. It's like a concept is really interesting to me, or like it's a theme I really want to explore. And in terms of like films, it has a lot to do with the characters. If I feel like they're very layered and very very rich, and there's like a lot to get my hands dirty, you know, I love to just you know, I'm so fascinated by why people do what they do, you know, and if it's fun to explore that, then I'm in.
Can you talk to us about the development of your aesthetic as a director? You spoke about Stanley Kubrick, but who else has influenced the way you tell stories, and has it changed or evolved over time?
I think, you know, I also grew up watching a lot of music videos. I still, to this day, love making music videos. So I, you know, I remember being in like 7th and 8th grade, and for Christmas I wanted the music video collection of Michel Gondry. I also liked the music video collection of Chris Cunningham, you know, British filmmaker, and also Spike Jonze, some of his early music videos. I think I also like that art form because it's very liberating, you know, it's very free. It's very much, you're not necessarily, things don't have to be super linear, you know. They could be just, how does a song make you feel, you know, what is the imagery that comes from that? So it's very pure to me. So I think that has been a lot of, it's been a huge influence for me as like early music videos. Yeah.
What is the responsibility of the artist to political culture?
The responsibility of the artist?
To political culture.
To political culture. Well, I think it's you know, art is, it can be a tool, you know what I mean? I mean, there's a fine line between propaganda and also inspires people to a movement, you know? So I think it definitely is a very, very powerful tool. and it's capable of a lot. It definitely can inspire people to movement.
Well, and one of the reasons I asked this is because you chose a very, in Romeo and Juliet, just to go back to that for a moment, mm-hmm. you set it in a very specific time, in a very specific place and city, when Germany was on the decline. And mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, what was it about that, context that you felt was important to tell at that point?
Well, I feel like a big part of it was that love, love can still come through the most difficult of circumstances, love and fear, and, on the other side of fear is, love, and I wanted to show how powerful that can be and how, how that can break down walls.
And this was during the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah. So that was a major thought to me. I mean, it was just, even on the metaphorical level, it was, being able to show that love can break down walls.
Do you see the climate changing for women in the entertainment industry?
I think it's definitely not 100% there, but I think it's definitely, there's an awareness of some, a lot of the oppression women have experienced, and as well as many other, ethnicities and cultures. And, it's just the beginning, I think. I just think it's beginning, but it's at least hopefully moving in a better direction than it was before. There's an awareness.
What kind of changes do you personally see?
I just hope that, there will be more diversification of, people, of all genders and races being able to have positions of power. I want there to be more equality, and hopefully we'll be moving more towards that direction.
Do you think major institutions are making those reforms, or do you think it would be more wise for marginalized people to create the institutions themselves to gain notoriety?
I've always been in favor of not waiting for yes, to make my own yes. And that's part of why I love making my own films and creating my own theater. Because, I think it's very easy to just sit around and wait and hope. But I think the real power comes from taking charge and creating our own institutions and creating our own opportunities.
Well, much like Bergman, you are from the theater, but have always sort of played around with, film, and then eventually turned it into its own art form. Do you prefer acting in film or theater better, or directing in film or theater better?
I love the theater is just so purely in the moment, We are on this journey together with an audience, and it's almost like I can feel their energy. I can feel, but I'm also like feeling the energy of, my scene partners and, what the play we're doing. And it's something so magical and so primal that it's intoxicating. But at the same time, I mean, I do love film. There's something about film that it's like, It's almost like you're almost like a kind of a can feel like, well, theater can feel this way too. It's like, it can feel like you're at summer camp, where you're all like this merry troop kind of, and maybe sometimes not so merry, coming together to make something happen. But I don't know. I like both. There's pros, to both.
You like a lot of takes in film, or just a few?
It's so funny because I think when I was younger, I think I was, maybe it's because I read so much about Kubrick that I had so many different takes, And then I think as I've gone on, I feel like I probably get it in a few takes because I also want to conserve.
Oh, Whitney?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. I thought we lost your thing. Yeah, go ahead. Stand by, listeners. We are having a bit of technical difficulty. We will be back in just a moment. For now, you can listen to the sounds of Carlos Puebla. We are Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Aprendimos a quererte desde la histórica altura donde el sol de tu bravura le puso cerco a la muerte.
Aquí se queda la clara la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia.
Tu mano gloriosa y fuerte sobre la historia dispara cuando todo Santa Clara se despierta para verte.
Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara.
Vienes quemando la brisa con soles de primavera para plantar la bandera con la luz de tu sonrisa.
Aquí se queda la clara la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara.
Te conduce a nueva empresa donde esperan la firmeza de tu brazo libertario.
You are listening to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. I am your host and comrade Sergio Castillo. We are here with Whitney Ellis, but we are still having a bit of technical difficulty, so I'm going to try something. This is the first time this has happened, but we'll see if this actually works. I am now calling Whitney to see if this works at all.
Here, I'm here.
Oh, you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay, great. So I guess we'll just have to do it this way. My apologies. I don't know what happened to the phone. That's never happened before.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's just live radio for you. So. Yes, so what were we talking about?
I think you said something about like, oh, do you like film or you know, theater better or something?
Right, yeah. Right. In terms of the amount of takes you like, I mean, because I know you said like Kubrick would sometimes shoot like 100 takes, and I think Charlie Chaplin was the same way. Do you find that it's hard to stay organic with a lot of takes, or is it something, do you like to rehearse in film?
Well, so this is the thing. Like I said earlier on, I feel like, you know, my film journey, I feel like I had, you know, did a lot of takes, and I think honestly my actors kind of hated me for it. And I think from that experience, I found that I like to have some rehearsal. I like to have, but I also really love to leave room for the actors to bring in ideas. What I do is for a project, I'll create a soundtrack That doesn't necessarily mean that's a soundtrack we're going to be using in the film or the play, but I like to get everybody in that kind of vibe. And then I like to, you know, maybe I'll have some, I'll do a ton of research on my own, but then I like to kind of, bring the actors some, you know, films or some references or some things just to get their minds going. And then I like to create like a Pinterest board or like a mood board. I like to share that with my designers. I'll have that for my designers, but I also have that for my actors. And then I like to really just a lot of, we'll have rehearsals, but I like to leave some time, some space for it to be very organic, for the actors to feel like they can play. Hello?
I'm listening. I'm curious, like, do you like a lot of rehearsal in the theater as well? I mean, do you subscribe to wanting to rehearse like the Moscow Art Theater did, or was it like Grotowski where you like to rehearse for a very brief amount of time, so all you have are your instincts?
Well, as an actor, I do like some rehearsal, but at the same time, I come from a big, like, improv background. I was at Groundlings for a long time, so, I'm very comfortable improvising and very comfortable just kind of thinking on the go and having that space of, you know, inspiration. So that's for me personally, but I've worked with actors where they want it to be very rehearsed and very planned out. If I'm doing a traditional play, I definitely do like to have rehearsal because it's you know, I'm a big fan of Lucille Ball, and Lucille Ball kind of talks a lot about, you know, she'll rehearse it. She would rehearse for I Love Lucy a lot, to the point where when she's in the moment, she doesn't have to think about it. And that's when a lot of organic stuff, happens.
And to our listeners who may not know, the Groundlings is a famous improv school in Los Angeles that taught the likes of people like Phil Hartman and a lot of the Saturday Night Live cast. Throughout the decades, you mentioned Lucille Ball. I mean, Lucille Ball said something that I thought was actually very interesting. When she was performing comedy, she says, "I don't think I'm funny. I think I'm brave." Mm-hmm. What kind of bravery do you think it requires to do comedy?
I think it requires a lot. It requires the ability to not care what other people think, and the ability to fall flat on your face and get up again, and to be able to dust yourself off and keep going, which I think is, you know, a metaphor for life. And so I see a lot of correlations there, but it's the ability to make a fool of yourself and just and not care and keep going and have fun with it.
Do you think the comedy scene is being more open to women now?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think it kind of goes back to kind of what I said earlier. I think in that it's really, you know, we can't wait for as you know, women and other groups. I feel like we can't wait for the opportunity because we could be waiting forever. You know, we have to take the chance to make our own opportunities.
I mean, you have this very, and you always have, as long as I've known you, this very do-it-yourself sort of attitude when it comes to creating art. You're, in many ways, like, you're not very patient when it comes to others, you know, mediocrity or time being wasted. I mean, what kind of advice would you give to a young artist or creator now the many years that you've spent in the industry?
I would say... You know, trust yourself and trust that you are enough, you know, and that you have it all inside of you, and tap back into that childlike state, because that's where I think the real power is. It's an unending source of imagination and freedom, and to really just tap into that, have some quiet time for yourself, whether that's going on walks, let your mind wander, and take a notebook with you, and you'll find from experience that a lot of great ideas come that way. And to just
take a chance and just do it. Do it without thinking. And then, you know, basically, I think with writing a lot, it's like it's very easy to, there are two sides of the mind, you know. There's that creative side and then there's the editor. And so when you have an idea, my advice would be to just go for it. Put it on the page, you know, put it up, put it on the canvas, whatever your art form is. And then take time, step away, and then take a look at it later.
This is a question I've been wanting to ask you for a little while now. With things like the digital revolution happening, it's easier than ever for people to create art and for people to see it. But do you see a risk in that traditional storytelling, say in the Aristotelian tradition, is becoming less relevant with things like Instagram and TikTok, where everyone seems to be able to make a movie now and does, but is that undermining the art of storytelling?
You know what? I think, I don't know if it's necessarily undermining the art of storytelling. I think you'll find the stories that are right for you. You know, the stories that you're meant to create and the stories that you want to read and want to watch. And, you know, I believe in curating, you know, self-curating. And what I mean by that is that, you know, if it's too much overwhelm, if there's too many, you know, other sources that don't inspire you, curate. You know, we have the power to watch and read and listen to what we want to. So if it doesn't inspire you, then you know, use that mute button.
The mute button?
The mute button on, like, you know, in social media, but I also mean that as, like, you know, a metaphor, you know, like in life, if things don't inspire you, you don't have to engage with them. You know, you have the power.
Right. Right. I guess for me personally, I view TikTok as very entertaining. And like Instagram it can be very creative, but I think it's also creating a generation of artists who are thinking in sound bites rather than stories.
Yeah. You know, and we never know. You know, we never know what great stuff will come of that. Maybe some things that we've never even thought about will come that way. I'm very open-minded. I'm very much, I'm very open-minded in that, like, I don't judge ideas. I just kind of let them come in, and then I find the ones that I'm gravitated towards. And then my advice would be to find what you gravitate towards, you know?
What is your ideal project at the moment? What would you like to work on?
Well, I am currently working on a feature and a dark comedy. I really do love dark comedies. And I think I definitely love humor, but I also love, you know, getting into the messiness of drama and the human condition. A combination of those two is my ideal.
You've spoken a couple times now about sort of the messiness in the characters, and this kind of seems like a lot where you talk about a lot of conflict or internal conflict, external conflict. Can you talk more about that, like what draws you to those kind of stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually where a lot of comedy comes from, you know? Like another, a favorite film of mine is Shoot the Moon, with Diane Keaton, and that can happen in life where things can be so intense and so overwhelming, and then you stub your toe or like something happens and you can't help but laugh. You know what I mean? Like it just. Sometimes, and I found that, you know, in my own, you know, when I've gone through things in life, it's like, what do? You turn to comedy, you know, you turn to, you know, for me, Bill Murray movies, you know, but that's, I think that's life is we, you know, you can't help but find some humor in some of the darkest situations.
You are listening to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. We are here with actor, director, writer, producer Whitney Ellis. We will be right back in one moment. And for now, you can listen to one of my favorite bands, The Blasters. You are listening to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Or not. apparently, we're again having more technical difficulties. We do apologize for that. Yes, so Whitney, I guess we can move into the my favorite part of the show. The segment, of course, is the Proust Questionnaire, developed but not necessarily invented by Marcel Proust, adapted for television by the French talk show host Bernard Pivot, and of course, perfected by the late, great James Lipton of Inside the Actor Studio. Whitney, what is your favorite word?
Pimento.
What is your least favorite word?
Any words that are shortened, kind of like obvi, things like that.
What turns you on?
Passion.
What turns you off?
Complacency.
What sound or noise do you love?
The sound of a tea kettle getting really hot.
What sound or noise do you hate?
The sound of someone honking, just being an asshole.
What is your favorite curse word?
Fuck you.
You join an elite club. What profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
Chef.
What profession would you absolutely not like to attempt?
An accountant.
That's pretty specific. And finally, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say to you when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Fancy seeing you here.
Quickly, tell us what you have going on and where our listeners can find out more information about you and your projects.
I am making a feature this year, and so it's my first directorial debut in the feature film form. And you can find out more about me on my Instagram at Whitney Ellis Island or WhitneyEllis.com.
And you have your various films on your website?
I have the trailer for one of my films on my website, but if you want to see some of the full, complete versions of them, I'd be happy to send them to whoever.
Can you also tell us about where the magic lies?
Where the magic happens.
Where the magic happens, excuse me, because you were not only an actor, but you were also the writer and director of this film. Can you tell us a bit quickly about this project?
Yeah, it was an idea. I, you know, kind of went back to a lot of Lucille Ball influences. I wanted to do kind of more of a physical comedy, but also some, you know, dramatic elements. It's a short film about this this struggling magician who lives at home with his parents, and he has this opportunity to play at a rich kid's birthday party, and so he needs to reconnect with his ex-girlfriend, and they do a handcuff trick, and it goes terribly wrong, and so it's what happens over the course of the night.
You can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems like you like to, or what I've seen like a theme in your projects is that you like to use almost a political context or a social context as the metaphor for a love story. Is that fair to say?
You know, I think I never thought about it that way, but I think that could be true. It's not a conscious thing, but yeah, maybe I'm doing that unconsciously.
Right. Because, well, I know there is at least another theme I've noticed to you is sort of this anti-authoritarian element to your work, in that you don't sort of like the rules, you know, quote unquote, and that you don't feel like married to a traditional form of storytelling. And I'm wondering if you feel that's a way of breaking out of something that feels binding.
Oh, yes, that is definitely true. Yeah, I feel like I enjoy letting my mind, you know, I love to break free of social norms and do my own thing.
but your, how does that affect your aesthetic?
It actually lets it, be more wild and free. And it's not, I don't like to have too many influences. I like to kind of, you know, stay in my bubble and just let it kind of wander, you know, and be free and kind of do its own thing, you know, not adhere to the social norms.
Which would be somewhat, ironically, very influenced by Kubrick, perhaps.
Well, no, I mean, I love Kubrick. And that was definitely an inspiration to start making films. But in terms of my own work, you know, maybe some of those images are in the, you know, my subconscious. But I like to really just let my mind wander and kind of, you know, create their own world.
Whitney, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for including me, Sergio. It's been a lot of fun.
That does it for us on Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Please tune in next week, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And now we're going to close out with a bit of the Blasters. You're listening to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark night. It's a dark. Changing, strangers moving in. A new boy fell for a local girl when she made eyes with him. She was young and pretty, no stranger to other men. But windows were being locked at night, the old lines drawn again. It's a dark night. He took her to the outskirts. He pledged his love to her. They thought it was their secret, but someone knew where they were. He held her so close. Things didn't happen anymore.